Thank you very much, Ambassador, my dear friend. Thank you also, Professor Baer, for introducing the person who gives the name to this foundation, and of course, who is at the center of this evening. I would like to thank the foundation for inviting me, and of course also the embassy of hosting this event. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to start out with a clarification. The title, actually, of this lecture is much wider in scope, and I hope you appreciate that I'm going to focus more on what is happening right now in Europe. I'm sure you've read a lot about it, and you seem to know, I guess, also about the unfolding tragic or whatever events in Europe, although hopefully I will be able to give a more nuanced picture of what goes on in Europe, and maybe even suggest some of some ideas how to overcome all of this. So I would like to focus on the current state of play in this European crisis, because I'm convinced that it will depend on how successful Europe will be in tackling the monetary situation, that this will ultimately decide about the future of the transatlantic relationship, whether we will have two partners still, or whether Europe will not live up to the expectations that are definitely around. Of course, many are puzzled why Europe is in such dire straits. After so many trials and errors, many things that have been done, usually too little, too late, what actually are the proper strategies or the proper options for the way forward for Europe is something which I would like to illustrate. I should also illustrate that actually the European fundamentals are, as such, are not that dismal as it might sound, but of course major reforms at the European level are urgently needed. So that is my first point. The challenge is how to achieve more Europe, how to resolutely move from a sovereign nation-state paradigm to a truly united and integrated Europe. And my second point is, it is clear that the transatlantic relationship, the traditionally strong alliance between the United States and Europe, needs to be assessed against the backdrop of the emerging multipolar world. Now, my point is that globalization, which in fact was kicked off by the West, but has also led to a relative decline of the importance of the West, that globalization requires from our partnership a new global policy design, a renewed alliance, so to speak, for the 21st century. As in the case of Europe, where I argue for more, much more integration, so the transatlantic agenda also urgently needs a fresh approach. But let me first turn to Europe. It is a truism by now that Europe is in deep crisis, economically, politically, intellectually, I would add. The facts are now 4 years into this great crisis, well known, already high and still rising unemployment rates have coincided with low and often negative economic growth rates. Many European banks are undercapitalized while high public guarantees are still outstanding. Already high government debt levels are rising due to the transfer of private debt into sovereign liabilities. And these rapid changes that signify this crisis have further accelerated after the outbreak of this crisis in September 2007. Just want to mention the collapse of the House of Lehman. And they are particularly painful for the 17 members of the European Monetary Union, the euro area. And this explosive mix has pushed some member states to the brink of default, leaving Europe's leaders fearing contagion effects. And the question is, how could a country whose GDP is about 2% of the European Union countries together, or about the GDP of the state of Massachusetts, how could Greece have such a devastating impact on the Eurozone? Now, even more worrying, there is no policy consensus on how to exit this crisis. And the increasingly distrustful and frustrated citizens, not to speak of the volatile market forces, are confronted with a cacophony of ideas, arguments, and conflicting proposals. This all has morphed into a political malaise of substantive proportions. Throughout Europe, incumbent governments have lost elections. Since the start of the euro crisis in early 2010, in fact, 9 out of the 17 eurozone governments have been voted out of office. Italy and Greece have seen caretaker governments installed by technocrats. Incidentally, both have formerly held positions at Goldman Sachs. Now, even in Germany, recent regional elections went against the ruling coalition and prompted Chancellor Merkel to fire one of her deputies. So disunity is all too visible. There is little common ground amongst European politicians over a number of fundamental issues, including, but not just only, the role of the European Central Bank, our version of US Fed. Should it focus on more price stability or be concerned with financial stability as well? Should the response to the crisis be more austerity, the German way, so to speak, or return to stimulus policies? More broadly, what are the economic and moral dimensions of an EU-wide fiscal solidarity, and where are the limits to this? In short, how much longer will German citizens have the dubious impression that they have to foot the European bill? And there's increasing concern that if the euro fails, the European Union will fail too. Now, this is due to political and economic reasons. Strictly legally speaking, a euro exit is not foreseen in the treaties and would be correspondingly difficult to handle such an exit from the European Union altogether, and that appears therefore rather unlikely. And economic reasons, of course, are also very much aware of them. We fear a contagion to other, especially the Mediterranean countries, the so-called Club Mediterranee, the countries from Italy to Spain and Portugal, and of course also Ireland. Now, it is for the first time, actually, in the history of the European integration that we are actually confronted with a realistic threat to the very political system which was established by the Rome Treaty 60 years ago in Europe. Now, ladies and gentlemen, despite all this doom and gloom, there are some strong European fundamentals around, nevertheless. After the fall of the Iron Curtain over 20 years ago, now Europe experienced a considerably strong and rapid convergence of the former communist countries and the inclusion into the wider European integration process. Germany alone spent 2 trillion euro to reintegrate the former German Democratic Republic, communist East Germany. Other West European countries spent billions in assisting their eastern and southeastern neighbors, including, of course, the war-torn Yugoslav successor states, in their transition to democracy and market economy. Austria's banks and businesses, in particular, are amongst the leaders there and have profited the most, actually, as such, from the end of the Cold War and the end of the European divisions. Now, even 4 years into the current crisis, the economic track record isn't that bad either. the European Union general debt level is lower than in the United States. We in Europe have roughly 87% GDP, whereas in the US it's over 100%, and that is quite amazing actually. Now, average unemployment in the European Union, again I'm speaking of an average, it's a mixed bag, but it's quite close to that of the United States. High, too high, but nevertheless not something which distinguishes us in a negative way, so to speak, from the United States. Europe's social cohesion is still holding up in the majority of the countries. Clearly, again, Greece is in dire straits. It's a special case, I would say. There are comparatively low poverty levels still, less income inequality, higher social mobility, higher public investments, including for education, health, social protection, and public infrastructure. Consequently, the economic performance in Europe is not uniformly grim. There are, in fact, considerable pockets of growth, like in Nordic countries, Sweden, Finland, as well as in the non-EU and oil-rich Norway. The Baltic countries are experiencing huge growth rates. According to the latest statistics, they grew between 5.5 and 7.6% of GDP in 2011. That is quite close to the Asian miracle. Poland is arguably the biggest positive surprise. Germany, considered the sick man of Europe only a few years ago, is back in force. The largest economy of Europe, and still the fourth largest worldwide, is experiencing an export boom of unprecedented dimensions. Or take Austria, where the unemployment rate is the lowest in Europe, barely over 4%. And it's doing quite well under the circumstances, and I'm not going to go into more of the details. And this all, ladies and gentlemen, could be crucial for the recovery, provided, and this is a crucial point, that Europe gets over its institutional woes. Now, seen from the point of view of the current crisis, the core problems are quite clear. While the monetary union was arguably successful, it stopped short of the subsequent reform steps that would have been necessary. A union-wide single fiscal system with a common European treasury, a central authority to manage the euro area, a European finance minister, if you will. In short, what is missing is actually a financial and economic governance. And the same applies also to the banking sector. It needs an overhaul, but definitely at the European level. A Euro-wide system of deposit insurance and oversight is necessary, as well as a common recapitalization. And we also need to put an end to the issue of too big to fail. But there, I guess, we're in the same boat with the United States. But Europe's sovereign debt crisis, its seemingly intractable economic and fiscal problems, are ultimately a problem of the political system. The economic and financial issues have to be put in the broader political context. And there the European Union lacks democratic legitimacy. We have to consider that about two-thirds of all relevant legal acts affecting the daily life of each and every citizen come, so to speak, from Brussels. The role of the national legislator has become increasingly diminished, dramatically reduced, in fact. On the Brussels end, in contrast, there is a very strong role of the non-elected commission, the executive arm of the EU, under the guidance of the Council of the 27 national heads of state and government. That is the development since, or the achievement, the acquis, as they say in Brussels, under the Lisbon Treaty. there is an appointed president, and there is a European Parliament with increasing powers, but still too weak to represent the will of the European citizenry. And this convoluted institutional setup illustrates the European malaise. Too far advanced to stop the unification project and renationalize, yet too weak in terms of an efficient government-like EU-wide decision-making and democratic legitimacy. The simple response to these problems is this: we need more Europe. And there are many good proposals out there to elect, for example, the president of the council, to involve more the national parliaments, to identify the commissioners, the ministers, so to speak. There is a necessity for more transparency, for more accountability in the legislative process. But Europe is very much still in the making. It's an unfinished project. And a recent editorial in The Economist stated that when talking about the European Union of today, you need to imagine the United States in the early 1780s, when Alexander Hamilton federalized the debt of all the states of the nascent United States. Now, money matters. The European Union's budget is about 2% only of the European GDP, compared to the US federal budget of about 20%. So there you can see that what the European Union can do and what it cannot do, just in terms of monetary matters. But money alone, of course, will not do it. In addition to more democratic legitimacy, the European Union executive needs a streamlined and efficient decision-making procedure. We need in those convoluted system of decision-making less unanimity and more majority voting. Actually, what we need is a substantive leap forward. And for the past 60 years, of course, already steps towards greater European integration have invariably been taken place as a consequence of transformative crisis. Thus, it is obvious that in order to exit the current mess, the European Union will have to make some hard choices. It will have to decide whether it wants to use the crisis as an opportunity or let it slip, and with it the project of an ever closer Europe. Now, there's an urgent need to much more engage European citizens in this project, the hearts and minds, as Americans would say. Europe is still too much a project of the European elites. What we need is a European demos, a common European purpose. But how to achieve it? While both the United States and Europe are multicultural, the United States has one language, lingua franca, a common public sphere, and a common popular culture. It has a national interest in its foreign policy. Europe is missing all this, does not have it. And let's be realistic, it will not be easy to build any of these things soon. But attempting to create a sort of common European public sphere might well help. But, ladies and gentlemen, how does this all fit now into the wider context of American-European relations? And here I am now, more towards the end, at my original topic. In a recent commentary in a big German newspaper, Dan Hamilton, who is with us, the director of the Johns Hopkins Transatlantic Center here in Washington, D.C., has argued convincingly in favor of renewing the transatlantic agenda. Just on the business side, although rapidly rising economies in Asia and Latin America have gained much attention, the United States and Europe remain the anchor of the global economy. The transatlantic economy generates $5 trillion in commercial sales per year and employs up to 15 million. It is the largest and wealthiest market in the world, a accounting for 3/4 of global financial markets and over half of the world GDP. No other market is as integrated as the United States and Europe together. And every day, roughly $1.7 billion in goods and services crosses the Atlantic. That is about 1/3 of total global trade in goods and more than 40% of world trade in services. Quite impressive. In the present US administration, if the present administration here in Washington seems to shift its focus to the Asia-Pacific area, the fact remains that US business exports is 3 times as much to Europe as it is to China, and 15 times as much to India. The European Union in turn exports to the United States nearly twice as much as to China. The United States and the European Union are each other's most important investment partners. In addition, research and development. The United States and Europe account for 60% of the top R&D companies. But more than sheer numbers, it's of course the shared values of liberal democracy and market economy. What connects the partners are of course also the what we call softer issues, which in fact those are the smart issues. Human rights, individual freedom, social responsibility. Just look at the Arab Spring. They did not speak about were not anti-American or anti-Israeli even. What they were looking for was actually what everybody around the globe, what we Europeans, what Americans cherish the most. Now ours is a fast-changing multipolar world. The United States, even as a diminished superpower, and Europe, if, and that is a very big if and when it gets its act together, will remain crucial actors in the common quest for novel concepts and solutions if there is a reform, be it for a rules-based global governance system. Here I'm talking about the established UN system, the international financial institutions, the Bretton Woods system, or be it the informal setups, the G7, which is now far less important, and the G20, which clearly plays the decisive role now. Or be it for global security, which of course goes way beyond the military power, rapidly dwindling natural resources, food security, climate change. Just by 2040, the food demand globally will be up 70%. We talk about asymmetrical conflicts like in the Balkans or in Syria now and in Libya. Fragile states. We also talk about the cyber challenges, IT. We talk about big data. And a recent World Economic Forum report pointed out that actually big data is an economic asset like oil. And add to those the global challenges of nuclear proliferation, where Andrew Pierre knows so much about it, transnational terrorism, which was probably overrated in the past, but it's still there, of course, or the major and vast demographic changes taking place. And these threats, and some more, strongly suggest that the United States and Europe cannot decouple from each other. To build a sustainable and resilient and fair global economy, US leadership and European commitment is indispensable. And there's much talk about decline, relative or otherwise. Yes, academic projections, statistical data, common sense suggest massive shifts that are already underway, as we know. Emerging economies, the so-called BRICS and others, are catching up in virtually all areas. And this will continue, although I very much doubt the linearity. Now, the Global West is part of this megatrend, And we need to invest and focus our efforts into what I would call the notion of frontier. And that is to strive for the cutting edge from inclusive global governance, the big issues, by engaging China and the others, to research and development, education, the whole gamut. Now, to stress is really that there need to be fair rules and opportunities for all. And I'm talking of a global all. Ladies and gentlemen, in 1972, the Club of Rome published the MIT study, The Limits to Growth. 40 years on, much has changed to the better, a lot to the worse. But today, it is not so much about the limits of growth. It is about the dynamics of growth. And those dynamics have triggered an unprecedented economic and societal transformation, a westernization, if you will, of global proportions. And the extractive lifestyle patterns, if applied around the planet, are clearly unsustainable. And this is, ladies and gentlemen, arguably our greatest challenge. And here comes in the idea of frontier, of a fundamental redirection of our economic model. Since the end, what will count in the 21st century is this: whether we aim for those frontiers or we give in to decline. Thank you so much.